Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
It's been a week.
It has been a week. It's all about the emphasis that you put on that.
It has been a week.
You know, I was thinking about this just a minute ago because I was writing up, it is that fickle beast known as award season in my other job. And so I was writing up a post for my blog about what works I've written that were eligible this year for awards. And I was like, whoa. My second book came out this year. That was this year. Every week feels like a year.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Time dilation. It's a thing.
Yeah, I saw a tweet that was a viral. That was like 2010. Got it started. 2011. You know, through 14. Beginning of the decade. 2015 went on forever. 2016, oh God, make it stop. 2017, still happening. It's like 2018, every minute is a year. 2019, why are you even measuring things in years anymore? I'm like, yeah, okay,
yep,
fair.
Pretty much. That's where we are now.
Yeah. Well, so I Monday morning flew to New York City.
Welcome to the coast.
And then Wednesday morning, I flew home.
Goodbye.
And Tuesday, I presented myself at Apple's stately Apple Manor in Tribeca.
Ooh, do you have to ride the pole down to the cave too? Or
they didn't let us. They made us take the elevator.
The worst.
But apparently there's a secret basketball court in that building. I don't know.
What?
That's what I heard.
That seems like.
Anyway, they have a, you know, this place that they use for briefings and stuff, and it literally, it's like a beautiful multi-story building that's like set up like a home that is apparently just Apple's New York briefing layer. I mean, they've got the money, and
sure,
it's not like
not?
New York real estate's a bad investment. So, although the stairs between the levels are glass, they're like Apple Store stairs. It's hilarious. Anyway, very nice place, and presented myself there at 8:30 in the morning, and was ushered in with about, I think, 9 people to a room, and chatted with Phil Schiller was there. I never know what to say to Phil Schiller. I talked to him about sports, because I know he cares about sports, so I asked him about if he was excited about hockey season, and made a mention of how the internet has made sports fandom really bad because there's a lot of knuckleheads. And he was like, yeah, that's, yeah. He says, what has the internet? I don't want to misquote Phil Schiller, but we did some agreement about how the internet has magnified a bunch of things about things we love that we don't love.
My Phil Schiller story is always going to be the one, I think the only time possibly I've met him, maybe twice, but was I got off the plane coming back from WWDC one year. And he was in the lounge in the Boston airport going back to San Francisco. And I did like a multiple double takes, like, wait, is that Phil Schiller? And we chatted briefly about, we grew up in the same town, technically, although many years apart.
Yes.
So yes. That's what I talked to Phil Schiller about.
So he was there. Tom Boger, who is their like hardware marketing manager guy, was there. And a few other people. PR people I know and all of that. And then, so they basically said, sit on down. And, you know, we were told to present ourselves, and there's lots of rumors about the 16-inch MacBook Pro, but, you know, we were not given anything other than the summons to appear. And in my case, I was given the summons to appear, and also that there would be a briefing and we would do an interview. So, you know, basically Phil gave some opening remarks, and Tom gave some opening remarks, and then, the product manager stood up, who I'd never met before, and she gave a presentation, like a keynote presentation, like on a big TV slideshow. And people were asking in the Slack, like, is that unusual? And it's like, well, they did it a lot. They do it on their press tours. You know, they build a slide deck even when it's not on stage at an event. That's not new. So it definitely uses their style. And they have this new thing that they're doing now where it has a bunch of different boxes that come up as the summation of the product. And they're like animated and stuff, which is really, that's a moment it takes me out of the presentation because I'm like, oh, I really like that style. That's very clever. And I think about all like making it and the choices you have to make and what the animations are going to be and how many they're going to be and how they loop during the thing because you want people to read the words. And like I got kind of caught up in the stagecraft a little bit. But yeah, it was, and so that was Shruti Haldeya. Sorry. See, you can't pronounce it the way it's written. If you say that, it's like Shruti Haldeya, and that's not it. It's Shruti Haldeya. And I asked her about that before I interviewed her. So she's the one I talked to later in the day. And so she gave the presentation. And then they basically did some Q&A that was off the record, although I don't think it means what they think it means, because I think off the record really means... one of these days I need to make sure this is what they mean, but I'm pretty sure when Apple says it's off the record in one of these briefing scenarios, what they really mean is that it's not for attribution. So, like, you can get more on background, not for right. attribution, is the kind of traditional way. And that's often the way that interactions with Apple PR works.
Yes,
is
I've definitely had
this. On background, not for attribution. So, they don't want direct quotes, and they don't want you to name who it was. But you could say, you know, I heard this, or Apple says this. Which is not off the record. Off the record is you can't talk about it. And in fact, there was an interesting tidbit that came out in the off the record section where a person I'm not supposed to identify, because it was off the record or on background or whatever, told this story about how they had done extensive months-long research with people about the keyboard to try and find out it, using all these different, you know, thinking about nerve endings on fingertips and audio feedback and like lots of different research to determine how they were going to design this new keyboard. And I thought, I can, you know, maybe allude to that, but it's in the off the record section, so I can't. And then Shruti, in her interview with me, said the same thing. And I was like, okay, well, that's on the record. So now I got it. So that was an interesting thing. So, yeah, they basically did that. And then here's the funny thing. So they did that, the product briefing. And then they gave us demos. They took us to various like rooms and areas in this place, and it was interesting because the message was not let's show you the 16-inch MacBook Pro. The message was let's show you all the pro workflows that can be done, and it was really kind of a combo of the 16-inch MacBook Pro and the Mac Pro. So they were kind of replaying some existing Mac Pro and Pro Display XDR, because the 16-inch MacBook Pro can be hooked up to two Pro Display XDRs, which is bananas. And it was very much like a pro workflows kind of set of demos. So it was, you know, composing. They had a John Williams, you'll like this, they had a John Williams symphony composition in Logic entirely done with software instruments in a single wow. Logic project.
That's incredible.
Which, according to them, this is the sort of thing that they used to have multiple Macs chained together, and each Mac would be running a portion of the orchestra in Logic, because they couldn't actually hold all of the orchestra in a single project on a single computer. And they can now with a Mac Pro. So that was cool. And it was very John Williams-y. I was like, oh, yeah, that's John Williams. It sort of starts out as a more martial John Williams, and then it kind of segued into a more kind of whimsical John Williams. You know what I'm talking about. So sure. I enjoyed that. I was like, oh, yeah, we're running the gamut of John Williams here. So, and I don't know, maybe you might have even been able to identify the composition. I don't know. But it was most definitely him. And then there was like, you know, there was a lot of video. There were video workflows they wanted to show off. There was like a little bit of Mac Pro news, right? Like the ship date in December, and they upgraded some of the specs, which really made me chuckle because the product's not out yet. It's not really an upgrade because
right.
It doesn't exist yet. So yeah. they've just changed what they're saying. So like they said they were going to sell it with at most 4 terabytes internal, and they actually made it 8. Yeah. And they said that they could do 3 streams of 8K video, but they updated the firmware on their crazy Afterburner box, and now it can do 6 streams of 8K video simultaneously. Although I will say the demo of that they showed me, the frame rate dropped precipitously when it was doing that. So maybe don't do that unless you absolutely have to have 6 simultaneous 8K video streams. Just a pro tip, literally a pro tip. So that took a while. And then at the very end, and then it was like almost one of those moments of like, they did a speaker demo, which was funny, where it was like, listen to these crappy PC laptop speakers compared to the speakers in the MacBook Pro. And then basically we're at the elevators and they're like, here's a MacBook Pro, sign this review document, and then goodbye. And turned us back out onto
goodbye.
The street. And then I had all day to use and write the, you know, story about it, use the on the product. I actually wrote it on the 16-inch. And then I had to go back at 6 and do our interview. It was a long day because then I came back and did Upgrade. And then I went to the diner across the street and got some dinner and then came back. And then I edited the interview while Mike was editing Upgrade. And then because there were some things we moved around in the interview. And I did one of those ground rules things. Like, if there's something that you're uncomfortable with or you think that you didn't say right, just let me know and we'll change that. And there were a couple of those. So I had to do all of that. And then I got to that point where I knew I was getting up at 6 in the morning to go to the airport and that the NDA was, the embargo was 8:30 Eastern. And I thought to myself, I should start packing my stuff up that I can, because it's going to be 6 a.m. and I'm going to need to roll out of bed and get to the airport. And I started to do it. And I was like, the act of putting like clothes in a bag was really difficult. And I thought, my brain is not working anymore. I need to go to sleep. And then Lauren actually texted me at that point, and I said, I am sorry, I can't talk right now. I have to lay down. And that was the end of my day. It was a busy, busy, busy day, is what I'm mm-hmm, saying. Mm-hmm, a busy day. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's.
Yeah. But a big day, right? I mean, it's like a momentous thing, though, because it feels to me, I don't know what you think. I've been talking here, but like telling you my story, but like it feels to me like this is a day we will point to and say that's the day that the MacBook Pro got fixed, like, or that the laptops got fixed. That was the beginning of something, that this isn't a one off, that this is like, this is Apple finally repairing the damage that it sort of did with some of its decisions 3 years ago.
I think what you're trying to say, Jason, is today will be a day long remembered. It has seen the death of the keyboard and will soon see the end of, I don't really know what to put at the end of that. I didn't do it Darth Vader enough either.
It is a good day to die. Sorry, I did some Klingons. We went Klingon.
It's a good day
there.
For the keyboard to
die. Yeah, that's right.
For butterflies to die.
There is no honor in low keyboard travel, said Martok.
This is interesting. So you and I both wrote pieces on this that were, I think, let's say complimentary. How about that?
Yeah.
That seems fair.
I mean, they're paying both of us for them, so that's good.
But they mesh together nicely. I think an element of like us. We both started talking about similar ideas of the fact that Apple does make changes to things. Like, a lot of time, it can kind of feel like you're shouting into the void, right? Like, God, the keyboard's so bad.
Into a black
happens.
Box, into a black
into
hole.
A black box, exactly. A space gray box.
That's right.
And
space
everybody's
isn't gray.
Everybody's
space isn't gray. Okay, sorry.
Everybody's temptation is to think that, like, Apple doesn't care. They're just going to keep doing their thing. They don't care what people think, which is, I understand that feeling, but it also is, when you kind of step back from it, a ridiculous statement to make. Of course they care. They want to sell things, and they don't want to sell things to people who are unhappy with them, because then they won't buy things anymore. It's just a matter of because it's sort of that space gray box, you see input, output, and you don't really know what the decision making is. And you don't know until it appears, right? Like,
right.
This is one of the few cases where I think, and this is what kind of I wrote about in my piece a little bit, at the end of the day, it was no longer going to matter how many times they claimed that they fixed the butterfly keyboard. Even if they actually fixed it, it would not have mattered. That's how far gone it was at this point.
And in fact, one could argue that they did fix it.
Right. Yes, you certainly could. But it didn't matter anymore because it was all about optics. This was all about, as soon as anybody saw butterfly anywhere near that, people were going to throw a fit. And so they had to change it, which is a crappy position to be in some ways, but also one that they dug for themselves by essentially not only, producing a keyboard that was problematic, but also not always doing the best job of addressing that. And I'm not sure they had a lot of better options. They did try basically everything short of saying, you know what? It's broken. You're right. Like, that was kind of the last straw.
Yeah.
And they more or less did that. I've been quoting our friend Daniel Jalkut a lot because I thought he had a great tweet about this, which was, I'm going to mess it up now because it was so elegantly phrased, but I'll look it up because I know it, John Gruber quoted, it concedes everything while confessing nothing.
Mm.
which I thought was great. Yep. Like that, and that was a reference to the fact that they called it the Magic Keyboard, right? Like, we all know exactly what that means.
Yeah.
But it also doesn't require them to say, we made a mistake and we are replacing that mistake and fixing it, right?
Right. The implication is strong, because if you go back, and I did, mm-hmm. to 2015, and I looked at the stories that I wrote, and I literally wrote my review of the Magic Keyboard, which came out after the MacBook came out with the new keyboard that everybody was like, mm-hmm. This is a really weird keyboard. I hope this doesn't mean they're going to try to put this on other keyboard or other laptops, because it seems like a bad idea. That was like, not hindsight. That was right when the MacBook came out. And then I wrote this Magic Keyboard review, and I was like, you know, we were worried there that they were going to just go all in on this crazy MacBook keyboard. But now we can see that Apple really can make a good keyboard, because this Magic Keyboard is great, and I hope they use this in all their laptops. And listener, they did not. But it was right there. And so by calling it the Magic Keyboard, they're literally saying,
right, exactly, because
it's not the Magic Keyboard. It is inspired by the Magic. It is marketing.
Yes.
It is. They are using. They are picking up a brand name of a product that people don't hate and saying, this is what it is now. It's not the thing you hate. It's a totally different thing that you like, right? And
yeah.
and that is what they're. That's the strategy here. Is even though if you flip through the history books, you're like, so you guys could have totally done this in 2015. And 2016, yep. And you went the other way, and now you're backtracking. And they're just not going to ever put it in those terms, but
sure.
It's
absolutely
undeniable that's
what
happened.
They did. 100% what they did. And that is the, you know,
they got
again,
it wrong. They got it wrong.
And it's not something they like admitting. No one does. No one likes to admit that. That's no fun. But they did make a change, right? And that is, I think, the part that comes out of this, right? Like, at the end of the day, as I was sort of saying there at the beginning, they want to sell their products. And if the keyboard is keeping them from selling their products, they're going to change the keyboard because
it doesn't matter how much they like the keyboard, right? It doesn't
exactly.
even matter if they think that everybody is wrong. It's too late. It's too late.
That ship has sailed. So I think this was good. This is a good move on their part
to
repudiate that.
Well, I don't want to say the most honest. Off the focus statement I got from anybody who's employed at Apple on Tuesday was, and I think it was Shruti, but it was while they did the boilerplate, right? While a majority of our customers really like the keyboard, which I love to know what that's based on, because you know, Jamie's got a MacBook, and we drop her off at school, and I say, you know, if you have problems with the keyboard, you know, we can work on that, and they have a replacement program and all that. And she says, oh yeah. And I already asked her this once, but she's like, oh yeah, the keyboard, the space bar doesn't work sometimes, but then you just keep using it and it works again. And I thought, first off, you should tell me this, because we could get it fixed. But second, it's like, she's a happy customer, right? Because she's never reported a problem, and there's still a problem.
Exactly.
It's just invisible.
Sure.
So that was the first part of the statement was, you know, while the majority of our customers really, you know, like this keyboard or whatever. But then the second part of it was not, you know, there were people who didn't like it. It was not as broadly appealing. And the final phrase that got thrown out there was really like essentially, it was a thesis of a Macworld article I wrote a couple years ago, which is the MacBook keyboard has to be broadly appealing. It has to be a crowd pleaser, right? Because there's no alternative.
Right.
And that was the
exactly.
acknowledgement I finally got from somebody who works from Apple, which is the second part of that statement, which is, yes, we know that you think that a lot of people like this keyboard, but a lot of people hate it. And they basically said, yeah, and it shouldn't be that way. This should be a keyboard that everybody thinks is fine. Not everybody loves. Everybody doesn't have to love it. The purpose is that everybody, the vast, vast, vast percentage, like 90%+ of people, need to think it's fine. Because there's no alternative.
It's a percentage game, too, exactly like you said, right? Because the answer is, look, we are, anything that Apple makes, they can go in there and say, you know what? 10% of people, I'm just throwing out a number, 10% of people, this is not going to work for them. But that is acceptable to us, right? That is the moment where you're like, you know what? You can't please everyone, right?
You can't.
So 10% is
fine.
But if that number starts creeping up and it's 15%, right? Like, that might not seem like that much bigger, but you do the percentages of how many customers that means, and that could be significant.
It's millions.
We don't know, right? Like, we don't know what percentage it has to hit before they feel like we need to change it. But the swing isn't as big. It's not like 50% of people hate it and 50% of people love it. That nothing operates on those percentages.
Yeah, the way I put it, I think in that article, which was like, Apple is cornering MacBook users, it was my real realization that the issue here is that these people don't have an alternative. Mm-hmm. And my point was, you can't, if let's say 60% of the user base absolutely love this keyboard, and 40% despise it, and the other keyboard design you can go with, 90% of them will consider it fine.
They won't even think about it.
5% will hate
it. That's kind of ideal.
Right. 5% will hate it, and 5% will like it. Yeah. I know that you look at it and you think, the majority of our users will be blown away by it and think it's the best thing ever. That's great. It's like, yeah, but 40% of the people will hate you. And you can't ever choose that product. You can't ever choose that if it's the only alternative, right? If you're not providing another alternative, you got to choose the crowd pleaser that everybody's going to think, man, it's fine. And so we get all wound up about this keyboard. I think it's more interesting as a bit of Apple analysis and trying to read Apple's mind than it is as a product, because as a keyboard, it's fine. Like, it's fine. The only thing that's interesting about it being fine is that it didn't used to be fine.
Right. And I think the point that you just made is, and I know we like to speculate about these things, but I think the point you just made kind of also puts paid to that theory about, you know, Apple eventually making the laptop where the keyboard is just like, you know, a slab of glass, basically. Yeah. Because 40% of people will hate that.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really hard move to make. Well, it might be an option.
I'm
right?
starting to think that the Microsoft approach has a lot of validity, which is you ship with a glass screen and you have a keyboard a magnetic keyboard that
something
plops
modular.
Over it.
Yeah.
That's more like the smart keyboard, which not everybody's going to like. But like the smart keyboard is, I was talking on a, if you're a Relay FM member, Fusion this month is me and Marco and Steven talking about the MacBook Pro, and that came up there, which is like, the smart keyboard is pretty great. Like, that's the butterfly keyboard that works for some strange reason. It's fine.
I like that keyboard too, honestly. I like that better than what I've used of the MacBook keyboard. That's fine. Mm-hmm. Teach their own, right?
Yeah. So I don't know. I think the point of my Macworld article was mostly this idea that I think there's been a very subtle but vitally important priority shift at Apple. And I think it all, like, the first time we really saw it was with that roundtable where they called everybody in the spring of 17 and said, yeah, that Mac Pro isn't working anymore. We're going to do a new one. It's going to take a while. We're sorry. We figured this out. Like, that was the sign. And not coincidentally, that was right after that fall where the of 16, where the laptops came out and people were screaming bloody murder. So I feel like that combined with the fact that the Mac Pro was completely stuck and they couldn't do anything with it, and everybody was screaming bloody murder about that too. Like, that the Pro audience was so angry. But the prioritization change, I think, and I use the Jobs' Law or the Ive Doctrine, this idea of everything thinner, everything lighter, as an example of it. It's not the only kind of internal Apple cultural thing, but it's like it represents something, which is Apple thinking that if we want your opinion, the customer's opinion, we'll give it to them.
Gives you, sure, yeah.
And that is the famous line about faster horses, right? Which is, you know, if you ask people in the beginning of the 20th century what they wanted from a vehicle, they would have said a faster horse and not a car. And that's a great little story to tell about how customers don't always know what they want. However, like all of these kind of stories, these little homilies, it can be completely misused and used as an excuse to not listen to what your customers want. And right. I think with the Pro products especially, Apple has kind of turned the corner there, and not like thrown away their old culture, but like reprioritized a little bit. And the way it came up in the briefing was, we asked, what was the priority operation for this product? And what we were told, and I don't know if that was in the off the record section, so I'm going to be very vague and on background about it, but what we were basically told is the premise for this product was, go make a a fast, powerful product that the pro customers will love, not solve for smaller, thinner, lighter. And the way they spun it was, well, the good news is it is,
yeah,
it is smaller, thinner, and lighter than the 2015 15 inch. Actually, it's a little bit bigger than the 2016 through 19 15 inch. But that was that came out of their process. But the guiding star going into it was not that. It was serve the pro customer. What do they want? And you know what? Very clearly, again, you do a lot of reading in the negative, the inverse of what they said, which is very clearly that wasn't the case with the last generation. I mean, and that's a surprise to no one, that their priorities were out of whack and they were making decisions based on features that they thought were important and throwing aside features that were more important to the customers. And they have seemed to have flipped that a little bit. And I think it's a huge thing, as small as it is. I think it's huge because it shows a little humility. It is Apple rethinking one of its premises that it held dear, especially during the early part of this decade as the iPhone was growing, that like this was the most important thing to do. And then in 2016 through 2019, they hit it wrong, where their customers mm-hmm. were like, no, you went too far. And you're not giving us what we need. And they backed up. So I think it's a good sign. My two anecdotes about it are the AirPods thing, which I mentioned on this podcast before, which was the implication was that they designed EarPods with a very small group of people who were mostly people who worked at Apple or in Silicon Valley or in the US. I'm not sure what that small group was. But what they said was the AirPods Pro, they had a very diverse group of ears that they measured from all over the world. And the implication there is Apple realized that they were too insular with their design. And the same thing happened with this keyboard thing, where you got the... I get the very strong sense that butterfly keyboard was a design innovation that was designed by... I know this is what people say, but I think maybe there's some truth to it. Designed by people who don't really care about keyboards and don't really care mm-hmm. about typing. And
well, yeah, I mean the point that you made, which is the thing I cheered about, was the return of the inverted T. And if you look at, you know, the I've got my Magic Keyboard right here, which has the full size left and right keys and the small yeah. half size up and down. And literally, the only reason to do that is so that all your buttons fit. Right.
Yes.
There's
yes.
no other reason to do it. It is less usable.
And you lose feel and all that. So
yeah.
the fact that they did a months long research project trying to figure out what people wanted in this keyboard, I think implies very strongly that didn't happen the last time. Right.
Yeah.
And
sure.
that to me, those two examples say it all about an Apple that got the pendulum swung so far to the customer doesn't know what they want. Don't ask them. No focus groups. Where it was like, no focus groups, okay, you don't want the public and conventional wisdom to chart your course, but at the same time, you do need to sell the products to them and you need to know your customer. So you do yeah. need to understand them and maybe do research about them, which is not the same as having a focus group tell you product sure. A or product yeah. B. And I think the pendulum swung way too far. And I will say, they put it in the context of pro products. There's an argument to be made that pro behavior is a little bit different from consumer behavior, and that some of the decisions they made are more correct on a consumer product than on a pro product. It's arguable. Like I said, it's arguable. I think consumers would like this keyboard better than that keyboard too, in general. But yeah, it's different. And you know, it's Apple is never going to straight up admit that they're wrong. But this is what it looks like when they are avoiding what is obvious is this, which is an apology, right? This product is an apology without the word being said.
Right. And I think there are two other interesting things here. One of which is you can also gauge from it a little bit all the stuff that didn't change, because mm-hmm. That's telling as well.
Yeah,
right?
They don't think that SD cards are a thing.
Yeah, exactly. They're not gonna stick a USB-A port on it. Right?
They don't want to do MagSafe. Right.
Yep,
even though I would love for them to build like one USB-C port with a magnet and have a special like thing and a breakaway and all that. Wouldn't that be nice? They
it would be
not a priority.
They're not gonna. Yeah, it's currently doesn't rise to that level.
Nope.
The other thing that I think is interesting, which you're kind of getting to, is the fact that so much of this apology tour, as it were, is focused on their pro users, right? Like
yeah.
redesigning the Mac Pro, coming out with the iMac Pro, revamping the MacBook Pro. Like
Mac Mini could be thrown in there.
It can, yeah, it's right on the dividing line. Even the iMac, to a certain extent, is also right on the dividing line. They have really focused on high-end, powerful hardware, which makes a lot of sense, too, because they've been pushing things like the iPad on kind of the more lightweight, portable side, right? So they can kind of cover the spectrum. But it does leave questions about, like, well, what does this mean for the future of the consumer products, like the iMac, or like even like the Mini and the MacBook Air, right? Like, which of the things that they have done in the pro-level stuff is going to trickle down and make its way into the consumer level products as well. Because I think you're right. I think they also want to appeal to consumers. And I also think they don't want to be in a world where they have to manufacture laptops with different types of keyboards. That just seems very like...
They don't want to do that. I guess if they had to do it, they do it. Yeah, exactly.
So in theory, I mean, it certainly seems plausible that both the 13-inch Pro and the Air will get this keyboard. Maybe next year, maybe the year after.
I would tell you that 13-inch MacBook Pro, I would be shocked if it doesn't have this new keyboard in the spring or by June at the very least. Like, yeah,
Air is the big question for me, mainly just because, it's unclear. The Air is a little bit different still in its layout, right? No touch bar.
Although the Air informed this, right? Because the touch bar has Touch ID separate button thing. I think you could make an argument that the Air might not get this keyboard, but this is something we talked about on that Fusion episode, but if you're not a Relay FM member, just to recap, I think it comes down to just how bad Apple's keyboard reputation is now, because, like, I think you could make an argument, and that Apple might want to make an argument saying, you know, with the new materials design version of this butterfly keyboard, it's fine. And it's not a problem anymore. And we can just keep shipping it in the Air. But first off, is it cheaper to make that one than this one?
Especially once you're dealing with scale, right? Like, if you're making this keyboard for all your MacBook Pros,
exactly.
Maybe you just want to make it for all of them.
Is it cheaper to just make the same keyboard for all of them? And also, it's the marketing issue, which is, can we afford to keep this keyboard in the MacBook Air when our reputation, when people are telling their friends, don't buy that product because of the keyboard? Even if you fix the keyboard, it's too late. And so that's why I think the next MacBook Air will absolutely have this new keyboard, because Apple's going to want to send the message, bad keyboard's gone. It's gone. It's gone. You can buy it safe. You buy a laptop again.
The corollary to that, too, is like, when you've announced your, especially when you put a marketing push to the point where you've got a brand, you know, like, it's the magic keyboard on our new MacBook Pro, and this other MacBook has a crappier, like, if you want to say, like, this is a great new keyboard we've designed, from a marketing standpoint, why would you not want to put it on everything if you're that proud of it, right? Like, that's, it kind of gets them in a little bit of a bind, because it's like, oh, you said this new keyboard was great, how come this laptop doesn't have it?
So they're hedging is really about the fact that they've got other products in the market with the keyboard, so they can't throw it under the bus.
I agree.
That's what it is. Now, the MacBook Air was last updated, as was the MacBook Pro, in June. Or no, in July. So, you know, if I had to predict, I would predict that the MacBook Air will be updated by next fall. Maybe even by next summer if they want to really push it into education some more. So, I would almost go and say that by next September, every Apple laptop will have the new keyboard. And it might not take that long.
I hope not, because I got my MacBook slowly dying. I need a new computer.
And Jamie's got that MacBook, and I really would like to replace it, but I don't want to replace it with a MacBook Air until they change the keyboard, if I can help it.
Yeah. And I've still got my fingers crossed for some sort of ultralight ARM-based Mac, but that may not happen next
year. And that's a case. Where, again, I think it's arguable if they made a product like that, if they could use the butterfly keyboard and say, you know, this is our latest one, which has proven to be completely reliable, or whether they're going to not be able to get away with that.
It's dangerous.
I know,
dangerous.
Right? Like, this is the problem, is that we may. And I don't like that keyboard. I'll say, reliability aside, I don't like the feel of that keyboard. And this new keyboard is much better. But I know some people do like it. I just feel like Apple may be in a position now where they've got a perfectly fine keyboard that they've worked all the bugs out of it, but it took them so long to get there that it's too late. And they just got to let it go. So, Yeah. Yeah. Inverted T, I actually like kind of squealed a little bit when they announced that part because I was like, I could not believe it. Like, I thought we were going to get the minimal apology from Apple. And instead, and they used it to say, we heard from developers. Like, they mentioned Vim, right? Like, that's an example of a product where the escape key is used all the time. And yeah, you can remap the escape key and stuff, but like, it's the muscle memory kind of thing, and so they put the escape key back, and they did the inverted T thing, which is huge because it breaks some of the symmetry, but it allows you to navigate more by feel.
Yeah,
and that's huge.
I gotta tell you, I was probably never gonna buy a laptop that didn't have an escape key, not because I use that much, but because I do use it. I use it a fair amount. And I mean, I'm on keyboards already that don't have the inverted T, and I suffer through, but I don't like them as much. So yeah, I'm glad that is coming to pass. But my bigger question is whether it's going to end up in a laptop that I want to buy. I mean, you know, worst case scenario, I'm sure it will end up in the 13-inch Pro, and I could get by with a 13-inch Pro just fine. But yeah, it's. I was hoping that it might make its way to the consumer lineup too. We'll have to see how that plays out.
I think it's got to happen.
Also, I would hope so.
Phil Schiller, in an interview with CNET, I want to say, gave another, you know, kind of impassioned defense of keeping the peanut butter away from the chocolate.
Yeah.
And saying basically, like, we don't think touchscreens make sense in Macs and touchscreens make sense on iPads, and that's what we're doing. So, you know, I look at that and I think, you know, the longer that they double down on this, I know there's that famous example of Apple saying nobody wants it until we do it right. But the way this comes out, I look at it and I think Apple's future strategy is absolutely this, which is the Mac is a legacy input method. And their strategy seems to be make the iPad more capable. And that's how you get a touchscreen Mac. Is that you never get one, but you get an iPad, which is already fundamentally a touchscreen that is capable of doing many more of the things that the Mac can do. And that literally, that is actually their strategy. And the fact that they've got a keyboard for the iPad, even though it's not a hard keyboard shell kind of thing, like that's their strategy. That just, they seem to be pretty, they will need to be harshly rejected in the market for them to change. And I think maybe one of the lessons that is not talked about as much from the 2016 to 2019 MacBook Pro debacle is, I mean, it's what you said about the touch screen keyboard idea, is that Apple has realized that Mac users are Mac users because they like it the way it is, and that if you change it to the point where it's not Mac enough and not familiar enough, they will reject it.
And you will not pick up new customers to compensate for that either. Is
right.
The challenge.
Well, and it's the PC market. You almost certainly won't. And so their strategy is keep the Mac the way it is and do all the innovation on, you know, or the bulk of the innovation in terms of major changes to the traditional paradigms on the iPad. And that seems to be their strategy, is like, we're just going to let it's not as sad as it was when it was sort of like, well, the Mac is never going to change because they are pushing some stuff like Catalyst and Swift UI and things like that.
And they know where their bread and butter is there too, right? That's the reason they focus on all of the pro stuff.
Yeah.
Is because currently the pro stuff is the stuff that you can't do as easily on an iOS device.
Exactly.
So that makes sense. You're adhering to your core market.
So I think I've gotten to the point where I'm just going to accept that the Mac's never going to do touch input.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. The one possibility I still see, the one possibility I do still see is something that they could do is, you know, you can weasel in some middle ground there somewhere and say, well, what if there's a thing that's not a Mac and it's not really an iPad and it's kind of in the middle? Yeah. I'm not sure that they will do that, but there is space, there is daylight enough that if they wanted to do it, they could still be like, yes, we've got a new thing here. It's not a Mac, but it's a lot of what you like about the Mac, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's possible. But they have to feel like there's a reason for them to do that. And right now, for exactly the reasons you're describing, it's not like they're going to draw Mac customers necessarily to that. And it might as well just, it may just eat up from the iPad side. So
yeah, you want both?
Why
both?
It?
Yeah. As Tihamar Marfenyo, who ran the Charta sandwich shop in Columbia, California, would always say when somebody came in, is no half sandwich. Order whole sandwich. eat half. Think about it, people. It's kind of, right? It's a similar thing. It's like, look, we got a Mac and we got an iPad. We don't sell half of one and half of the other. You just use one or use both. Like, yeah. that's Apple's strategy. And it's like, yeah, order whole sandwich, eat half.
Yeah, I have to say, as someone who has been mostly a Mac laptop user, I have been using my iPad increasingly for mobile work in the last few weeks, mainly because my laptop battery is starting to die.
Yeah.
I was doing a bunch of tasks that I can do just as well on my iPad in most cases. And then I ran into an issue the other day where it's like, oh, I got to work on this manuscript I've got. Oh, it's in Scrivener. And I was like, well, I forgot to bring my laptop. So that's not happening.
Yeah, because Scrivener, there is Scrivener on iOS, but
I have to like prepare if I'm going to do that.
Right.
I have to like take steps to make sure everything's in the right location and everything's updated and closed in various places.
Mm.
So it's not suitable for that right now. But, you know, when I was editing a manuscript in Word, it's fine. I can do just as well on my iPad, frankly.
I will say that, and I know I've told you this before, but I have done a battery swap on a MacBook Air, and it's not that bad.
As did I. And my new one is still crappy, so something else is going on there.
That's not good.
Yeah, I put in a new one, and it has said service battery since day one. I don't know if it was a bad battery. I don't know if the power management thing's going.
Oh, you should ask. So there's a thing, yeah, that's a bad thing. It may not be attached right, or you may have to do a power reset or something like that, but you should service battery warning.
I've messed around with it a little bit, but I haven't found a way, and it only lasts like an hour and a half, which
that's
is terrible.
Not good. No,
yeah, not ideal. No. But
you're
holding
out. Well, you could get an enormous 16-inch
laptop. I need that not at all. It's too much laptop.
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, that's the other thing is that I, you know, as somebody who used the 12-inch PowerBook and used an iBook for a while and a MacBook and used the 11-inch MacBook Air, that 15-inch is just like, oh my God, it is enormous. And I get it. Like what I said to Marco yesterday was, it felt, when I was using it on Tuesday, it felt like I was using my iMac Pro. That's what it felt like. And because it is about as fast as that and huge screen. And, you know, that's what it is. And that's what it's meant for. It's a giant pro laptop with a giant screen. And it's meant for you to do that pro work that I do at my desk on my iMac Pro wherever you want. And that's what it's for. But that's never how that's generally not how I've used laptops. And because I went back and forth to work and home with it in my backpack as my primary, I always wanted the lightest one because I could feel
feel it
every day.
Yeah, and I love the 11-inch Air for that reason. It's super compact, and I'm sad that Apple doesn't make anything that's quite in that market.
And again, if they made an Air with a better keyboard, I think that would be your answer.
That's what I'll do. By like WWDC next year, if that is my option, I will buy one.
Yep.
100%.
Yep.
So.
All right. Well, there's another week next week, so
probably not what I signed up for.
Probably not like you didn't sign up for weeks to repeat.
Oh, to be this long, really?
Oh, yeah. Okay, I hear that.
I will indulge in a bit of shameless self promotion.
Oh, yes,
though,
please.
If I may, before we go, I for one thing, I'm selling shirts again for my inspired by my books. If people are interested in buying those, go to dmorin.com/shirts, or you can go over to Cotton Bureau and search for me. And I'm also running a giveaway on my blog for the next week and a half or so. I'm giving away some signed books, some audiobook copies of The Bayerian Agenda, some pins. So if you go over to dmorin.com/news, you can find the post with all the giveaway stuff in there. So
all right.
It's fun. It's free.
And
do that.
And while you're buying Dan's shirts, you should buy my shirts if you want. Theincomparable.com/shirt is up for the next, 2 days. And upgradeyourwardrobe.com is up now. We brought back the upgrade hoodie and the Dongletown t-shirt, the original Dongletown, including the orange one, which I love, and a new shirt, the Dongletown Butterflies Inverted T, in which I channel Dan Morin. And even if you don't buy the shirt, go read the description because I'm very proud of it. It is
pretty good.
A lot of keyboard puns in a very short paragraph.
It'll make you want to escape.
It will make you want to escape if you can exert enough control. I command you to check out.
Jason, I need some space.
Yeah. Anyway, check out the inverted T. Get it? Huh?
And, oh, boy.
Yeah. the Dongletown butterflies. The butterfly is like the command symbol. It's great. It's amazing. Amazing work by Simon. Amazing. So
we also designed my shirt. So yeah, so we've got a lot in common there.
Buy some shirts is what we're saying. Or don't. Thank you for your support, regardless of whether you buy shirts or not. And until next week, which is going to happen because it's inevitable. Bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.